G'vachin Shavua Tov, words I don't normally begin the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha with, but we are living in very unusual and awkward times. I'm so grateful that you're with me tonight. Virtually, we can create a community of learners and be together. As difficult and as painful as it is, as I'm looking out on a virtually empty sanctuary, normally filled, coming together. I'm grateful to my children who are here so that I have human beings I'm actually talking to. And I want to express my thanks to my dear friend Carmi Gross for helping me with the technology this evening. This is one of the sadnesses, this empty shul. The shul so used to hearing the sounds of tefillah, the sounds of community, the sounds of chesed, the sounds of love, the sounds of Klal Yisrael. And here we are, once again trying to return and restore those sounds. And therefore, even though it's night, it's already Motzei Shabbos, I still wear the talis. And I chose to stream it from here, our beloved Rang Sanctuary, to normalize the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha as much as possible. Usually before we begin, Shlomi Legassi leads us in the singing of how we sit together, how beautiful it is, Shevas Achim Yachad, when we come together as one. So tonight we are as one, wherever you are, wherever you're watching, whenever you'll watch this, we are as one in our collective tefillah, hope and prayer that we can return to a time of normalcy, of health, of safety, of security, of confidence, a time of congregation, of collecting, of being together, of camaraderie, most significantly a time of community. I want to thank our sponsors for this evening's Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, the Friedman and Cohen families who sponsored in memory of two people who were so incredibly special to me, role models and mentors of mine, Rabbi Simcha Friedman, Zichrono Livracha, and Helen Cohen, Aleha Shalom. Rabbi Friedman was an amazing advocate for the Jewish people. He fought and he demonstrated and he protested and he led by example. He loved the pasuk over our Aaron, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, not because it had his name, but because it was the motto of his life. He had a perpetual smile. He was the embodiment of optimism, but not a foolish optimism or naive optimism. It was an optimism with a realism and an optimism that inspired an initiative. We miss him tonight. We miss him every day. We dedicate our words in his memory. And his machatenus to Helen Cohen, another incredibly special person who was a model to so many of us, who too fought for the Jewish people at every breath she had. She too was a model, a paradigm of positive thinking and of optimism, of faith, and even as she endured and suffered towards the end of her illness, even when that illness robbed her of the ability to speak the last Pesach of her life, she nevertheless continued to mouth the words to the song, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. Knowing her condition and knowing it was likely her last Pesach, she maintained that optimism and hope that next year she would be in Yerushalayim. We draw strength from the two of them and we dedicate our words in their memory. My friends, these are very, very challenging and dangerous and threatening. They are incredibly scary times, times of uncertainty and times of doubt, times that have rocked our confidence and faith, times that have shattered so much of what we take for granted, so much of what we've come to expect, so much of what we feel entitled to. And during these days, all of us are jarred, we are all shaken to our core, and we're all worried. Some are worried about loved ones who are in sick in need of a refuah shlema, and we pause to think about them. Hashem should give them a speedy and a painless and a full recovery. As quickly as this illness came, they should be restored to good health. And others are yet grieving a loss of people they never dreamt would be sick or gone this quickly. There is real and incredible and acute pain in this world. If you look at the source sheets, and they're available if you're watching on whatever platform, they should be in the comments section, in the chat section. And I encourage you to follow along, though we will not get lost in the minutiae in the sources themselves. I'll summarize them mostly. But on the top of page 3 is a picture, and that was from Thursday. This has undoubtedly continued to this coronavirus database telling us about how it's affected everyone across the globe. There's not a human being alive who was not affected by this horrific pandemic. The image, the picture below it, shook me to my core. There have been certain pictures, certain memes, certain images that have really caused me to stop and really evoked emotion. And this one, of the entire globe, of all of humanity wearing this mask, the idea that this isn't a region or a people or a religion or a political party, this isn't a state or a country or a continent, there is not a human being on the globe today who is not negatively impacted and therefore not incredibly scared. We've introduced new words to our vocabulary that we, our children, never heard of, that we would hope we never would have had to use. Words like pandemic, words that are an anathema to the entire Torah, social distancing, words like quarantine, we're prisoners within our own home. And these words elicit a sense of panic, even hysteria. They're scary. Scariest are those with the health issues. But also scary are those who've been hit by the economic impact, who don't know how they'll pay their mortgage or put food on their table, who aren't sure they can continue to send their kids to Jewish school, or what job will be left, if any, when all this is over. We're scared by the prospect of anti-Semitism. As often happened throughout history, when pandemics spread, when plagues impacted the world, they turn to and they blame the Jews. And tragically, there are a minority of Jews giving them good reason, and we hope and pray that we can offset with our Kiddush Hashem any Chilul Hashem that's happening. But make no mistake, it's so hard to be confident. It's so hard to be happy. It's so hard to be optimistic. It's so hard to be sure of anything. People around us are struggling and suffering. How do we get through this? How do we not only survive? How can we come through on the other end with a sense of thriving? If your family WhatsApp group is anything like mine, then the messages alternate between things that make you laugh and things that make you cry, because it's the only way we can survive right now. We read a meme or a gif or something that makes us laugh, and it's followed immediately by news or information about someone, by a statistic or a forecast that literally makes us stop and cry. Laughing and crying is our new reality. On page 4 is an article that came out from a nurse, Blimi Marcus, who describes that she had to download on her phone the vidui. She's not a rav, she's not a chaplain, she has no place saying vidui, and yet they're the front line, the first line, our incredible medical personnel for whom we're davening. How she had to have a three-way conversation with a Hasidic 60-year-old patient, her son, their rabbi, to make end-of-life decisions and to recite vidui. And she writes about giving advice and prescribing Ativan, calming the nerves and removing the anxiety of those who need to be numbed and guided to attend the funerals, in addition to the masks and gloves that she is providing. This is a new reality. It's unfamiliar to any of us. We don't have a playbook of how to navigate these uncharted and stormy waters. Although I believe, my friends, we do. We have a playbook called our Torah and our tradition. We have a playbook called our timeless Haggadah and this holiday of Pesach. We have a playbook and we have a coach called Eliyahu HaNavi, who can guide us and escort us, take us by the arm, and help us preserve our optimism and hope, our belief in a brighter future. But we first need to name what we are going through. An amazing article on page 5, I'm grateful to my brother-in-law Binyamin for sharing it with me, from Harvard Business Review, that talked about the fact that so many of us are going through something that we can't quite put our finger on. We can't quite name. We don't fully understand. And the beginning of managing it, the beginning of managing ourselves, is to give it a name. And this great expert in the Harvard Business Review article gave it the name grief, and describe something I know resonated deeply for me, and I hope it does for you. That the truth is, what so many of us are going through is a feeling of a sense of loss. Even if we're so blessed and fortunate not to have lost anyone we love, we've all lost our innocence. We've lost what we've come to be used to. We've lost the ability to celebrate and to mark occasions the way we want. I made a l'chaim over Zoom with someone yesterday who should have had the shalom zachar of his baby last night. Weddings that parents of the chassan have to FaceTime into. Big milestone events and small ones. A happy birthday to Ronnie Eisenberg on his 36th birthday tonight. They're all marked not fully, not completely, not the way that we want. And we feel a sense of grief. A grief over what we've lost. An innocence, a connection, community. A grief, what he describes as anticipatory grief. That there is a storm coming, something bad out there. It will impact us in some way, and we don't know what it is. It's that doubt. It's that uncertainty. It's that fear factor. It's grief. We are grieving. We have all lost. We've lost our confidence. It's been shaken. We've lost what we've taken for granted. We've lost what we've looked forward to every morning that we wake up, and we're sure as day will come. Unhealthy anticipatory grief is really anxiety. And it's the feeling we're talking about, he writes. Our mind begins to show us images. The goal is to find balance in the things you're thinking. If you feel the worst image taking shape, make yourself think of the best image. Not everyone I love dies, maybe no one does, because we're all taking the right steps. Anticipatory grief is the mind going to the future and imagining the worst. To calm yourself, you have to come to the present to overcome that sense of grief. But we've given it a name. We've all lost something. We've lost going to the hotel for Pesach or our family or having those guests. We've lost something we were looking forward to, which got delayed or pushed off or canceled altogether. There are those who are grieving the worst grief, and for them we daven from the bottom of our hearts. But we are all grieving some type of loss. How do we feel optimistic and hope? How do we feel faith when we're suffering from that grief? That's what we'll talk about tonight. One of the most exciting parts of the Seder, and by the way, the first step that we take to overcome grief, to come to the present and to find a sense of strength and hope, is to study Torah. It's what we've been doing for thousands of years. The study of Torah is what carried us through an Inquisition and a Crusades, even a Holocaust. It carried us through expulsions, pogroms, and plagues. It carried us through illnesses. It carried us throughout our history and until today. And studying Torah, what we're going to do tonight. When is the last time on a Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos, at 9:13, you were studying Torah together, hopefully with so many other people? Maybe I'm by myself, I have no idea. But together with so many other people, that is the greatest thing we can do, to be in the presence, in the present, to be in the moment, to draw from the wellspring of strength that our ancestors dug and filled for us. And that's what we do tonight. Cup of Elio is one of the most anticipated moments of the night. Who doesn't love it? It's like the seventh inning stretch. Everybody needs to stretch their legs a little bit. Someone's designated to get up, to go, and to open the door. It's our version of that character who comes to every home in the Jewish people simultaneously. Every continent on the globe, every home in every time zone. Elio HaNavi comes. He doesn't come through the chimney. He doesn't climb through the window. He doesn't walk through walls. We have to get up and open the door for him, which is peculiar. And we'll come back to it. But that moment where we sing Eliyahu HaNavi, we look at that cup, in countless families, parents play a little game and try to distract the kids while they spill and then argue to the children. Eliyahu HaNavi himself took a sip. There are certain universal customs, and we all anticipate and look forward, and here's the strangest thing. Do you know that the cup of Eliyahu does not appear in the Mishnah? It's not appear in the Medrash, doesn't appear in the Gemara. It's not quoted by the Rambam, it's not in Shulchan Aruch. What we come to take so for granted, what we look forward to with such anticipation and excitement, isn't even really part of our tradition, doesn't really show itself until relatively recently. So what I want to spend our time is, when was it introduced, why was it introduced, and what can we draw from the image, the symbol, from the living legend, Eliyahu HaNavi, who will be in every one of our homes this Wednesday night, as he is every year. The Sefer Ma'adani Shmuel, source number 3, quotes a tradition from a Sefer Ma'orei Or. Inyan ha-minik sh'maziges koshel Eliyahu nimshach mishum derech cheirus. Sh'abal bayis eino toreach limzog levnei beiso. Sh'gam heim mesubim b'shulchan k'deshu l'trach inichu tchila kos gadol limzog b'manu. He quotes a very unusual reason, a suggestion. He says the cup of Eliyahu was there to make it easy for the Baal HaBayis. He doesn't have to walk around pouring for everyone. By having a large cup in the middle of the table, everyone has equal access, and it is a display of freedom. I'm not pouring for you. Everyone has equal access, and therefore I can be free. But the author of the Ma'adani Shmuel himself rejects it and says that's not our tradition. We don't have it from the beginning of the Seder. We only fill the cup of Eliyahu when it's time for the fourth cup, when it's time to say Shvoch HaMascha. So again, I ask, when was it introduced? And why was it introduced? And why are we continuing to do it today? The first time it's mentioned, the cup of Eliyahu, is by the Maharaz Binga, Rabbi Zelikman, in the 15th century, in the 1400s. The Gemara in Pesachim Daf Yud Gimel tells us, Kvar muftoch lehen liYisrael, there's a promise to the Jewish people, that She'ein Eliyahu ba lo ba'arvei Shabbosos v'lo ba'arvei Yomim Tovim. Eliyahu HaNavi is not coming Erev Shabbos, he's not coming Erev Yontif. Why not? It's a good time. It's a holy time. People are home, they're getting ready, they're dressed in their finest. And the Gemara says, B'nei HaToreach, because you got to get ready for Shabbos. You have to get ready for Yontif. It would be a distraction if Eliyahu HaNavi came. And commenting on that Gemara, in the 15th century, the Maharaz Binga writes, he says, we have a custom, Re'isi Yesh B'nei Adam B'lel Pesach, We've seen a custom in the 15th century, in the 1400s. Some fill a cup, they put it in the middle of the table, and they declare it's the cup for Eliyahu HaNavi. Velo yadati me'ein zehatam. I have no idea, he writes, where in the world this comes from. I don't know where it comes from, but this custom has begun to spread, it's begun to proliferate. We also find it mentioned 200 years later in the Pesach Me'uven, source 6, Rav Chaim ben Benisti. Here Rav Chaim ben Benisti of Izmir, the author of the Knesset HaGedola, it's a Sephardic reference to an Ashkenazic custom. He says, V'yirush ezeu ha-minig sh'ris l'ktsas Ashkenaz. I see among my Ashkenazi brethren this custom of pouring a cup for Eliyahu. And he says, you know where it comes from? It comes from an interesting halacha. We know that if someone made Kiddush or Havdalah over a cup of wine, someone else comes along and they want to make a bracha over that same cup. If it's been used before, it's what's called pogum. It has already been used. It's invalid. It's ineligible. It's a kos pogum. You have to add more wine to it, or you could add the unfinished wine back into the bottle and then pour it. But to use wine that previously a bracha was made on and use it again would be a kos pogum. That makes it ineligible. Says the Pesach Me'uven Rav Chaim ben Benisti. You know the origin of this Ashkenazi custom of a cup in the middle of a table? You know what it was for? When I went to KBY, back when I had hair, back a few decades ago, it was an Israeli custom at the time. I don't think they do it as much in Israel today. It's not so... In the middle of the table, there used to be an empty bowl, an empty bucket. And as you ate, the remnants of what you ate that you didn't want on your plate anymore, you dumped in the bucket in the middle of the table. If you ate chicken and you finished, you didn't want the bones on your plate as you continued to eat, you dumped it on the bucket in the middle of the table. That was a minhag then. I don't think it's the minhag now. It's good reason we have evolved well. Says the Rav Chaim ben Benisti, you know where the origin of the cup of Eliyahu is? Because people used to pour out the leftovers so that the cup wouldn't be a kos pogum and it wouldn't invalidate four cups of wine we have to have. Each cup needs to be a brand new cup from the beginning. You pour out what you didn't finish of the first cup, of the second cup, of the third cup, and by continuing to pour it out, you're not double dipping, you won't have a problem of it being a kos pogum. We're not satisfied by this reason, and we're not satisfied for a very good reason, because we don't observe that halacha of post pogum in that way. We don't believe you need to empty out what's inside, you can just add more. That can't be the origin. And why would that be associated with Eliyahu HaNavi? A dumping bowl in the middle of the table to get rid of your leftovers? Oh, who can we name it after? Whom can we honor with the garbage bowl in the middle of the table? Let's call it the garbage bowl of Eliyahu. That doesn't make sense. So where does it come from? We have to go back to the drawing board. The next reference we have is in the Sefer Birchas Eliyahu. Rav Eliyahu was the Beis Din of Ilyiniv in Poland, the Av Beis Din. And at the end of his Sefer, he quotes a series of tshuvas from the Maharam Chagiz, Rav Moshe Chagiz, who lived in the 17th century. And he explains that there are two separate cups, one to avoid post-pogum, and he says, no, there's another cup that's called the cup of Eliyahu. Don't confuse the two. And it's in this generation, my friends, and I want you to note the date, because we're going to come back to it. History buffs who are listening will, of course, immediately come to mind what was happening in the Jewish world at this time. Rav Moshe Chagiz lives 1671 to 1750. But we see it proliferate. The Chok Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Reischer, source 10, he lives 1670 to 1736. He quotes the custom of Cup of Eliyahu. The Berahetev, Rav Yehuda Ashkenazi, 1730 to 1770. He quotes the custom. It's in that generation, it's at that time, it's at that point in our history that we begin to see the proliferation, the spread of this custom of having a cup for Eliyahu. We even find Sfardim again referencing the Ashkenazi custom. Rav Chaim Pelagi, 1788 to 1868, source 12, in his work Moed L'Cholchai, he writes, Be'Ashkenaz, Be'Haschel HaSeder, Memalan T'chila Kosla Eliyahu HaNavi, our Ashkenazi brothers, at the beginning of the Seder, they fill the cup for Eliyahu, and then they leave it for the Balabayas, who the next day puts it under his bed and uses it the next day. He says, we drink it during the Seder. So again, it's in that generation you see it, but we don't like this reason. So back to the drawing board. Where did this come from and what can we learn from it? We're all desperate for a message of hope and positivity and optimism. And I'm going to give it to you tonight from Eliyahu HaNavi. Deliver his message. Second reason suggested, the second halachic reason, it comes from the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, Rav Elio Kramer, one of the most brilliant minds, not only of his generation, of all of Jewish history and all of Jewish generations. And he says it's based on the following. If I were to ask you, and if you were actually here with me, I would ask you, how many cups of wine do we drink at the Seder? Wake someone in the middle of their sleep and they'll know to turn to you and tell you, four cups of wine we have. And that's the Mishnah in Arvei Pesachim, source 13. Mishnah says, Erev Pesachim Samach Lamincha, you can't eat. And, Lo Yivchas Ulamar Bakosa Shoyayin, even the impoverished indigent person deserves their 4 cups. Everyone has to have 4 cups. We all know 4 cups of wine. But it's not so simple. In the Otsar HaGaonim, it quotes the Gaonim out of Machlokas. The Gaonim come after the period of the Amoraim, before the period of the Rishonim, and there's a debate. The Gaonim find themselves centered in 2 geographic locations, the Gaonim of Sura and the Gaonim of Pumpedisa. Sura is in the southern part of ancient Babylonia, west of the Euphrates River, and Pumpedisa is the name of another ancient academy. It was founded by Rabbi Yehuda ben Yechezkel in the 3rd century, and today Pumpedisa is more familiar to us by the name Fallujah. But Sura and Pumpedisa, the Gaonim, the great scholars of these two centers, of these two academies, had a big debate. What is the right girsa? Which is the proper tradition? Do we have 4 cups at the Seder, or do we have 5? Why would you say 4? The Yerushalmi and Pesachim gives us lots of reasons. We're all familiar with the most famous among them, that there are 4 languages of Geula, 4 statements of redemption, Votseisi, Vitzati, V'ga'alti v'lakachti. And corresponding with each of the stages of Geula, corresponding with each of the evolving chapters of our redemption, is another description, another language. And that's why we have 4 cups to commemorate. But the Yerushalmi gives us more reasons than just that. The Yerushalmi, can't hear? People can't hear? I'll scream louder. The Yerushalmi says, Kenerga arba geulos. Maybe it corresponds with the 4 stages of redemption. Or maybe arba koso shel paro, the 4 cups that paro drank. Can I get arba malchios? Maybe it corresponds with 4 exiles that we have suffered. There are so many reasons suggested that correspond with the number 4. The Das Zakenim offers more reasons. Maybe it corresponds with the 4 yeshuos. Maybe the 4 cups the Sar HaMashkim spoke about to Yosef. So many reasons are offered. But the other Gaonim had another opinion. And they said, you know, we have a tradition of 4, but there's a reason to argue 5. And what's the reason to argue a 5th cup? Why a 5th cup? Are there only 4 languages of Geula or more? Don't forget, the 5th language, Vehevesi, we will be brought into Israel. So the Gaonim have a debate. Is it 4 or is it 5? What do we follow? The Rambam, Tur, Rosh, Rif, Rabbeinu Hananel, they all follow the Gaonim of Sura and they have a 5th cup. The Rashbam and Tosfos follow the Gaonim, the leaders of Pumpedisa, and they only have a 4th cup. So we have a debate. What do we follow? If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, source 22, he doesn't mention a 5th cup. He only says 4 cups. And it's astounding, writes Rav Menachem Kasher in his Agada Shlema. The Beis Yosef, who makes a living out of quoting all the opinions, doesn't even acknowledge, doesn't even quote the opinion of the Gaonim that say 5 cups, doesn't make a reference at all to the 5th cup, and he has a long essay trying to uncover why that is. The Rama comes along, and the Rama of Moshe Isserles does mention the 5th cup. He says, Mishu istinus otoiv harbe lishtos. Someone who is very sensitive, someone who is very thirsty and wants to continue to drink at the Seder, yachol lishtos chos kos chamishi, can drink a 5th cup, v'yomar alav halal hagadol, and recite upon it the halal hagadol. The Rama and the Levush mention the 5th cup. The Maharal, who lives at the same time as the Shulchan Aruch, acknowledges the 5th cup is not in the Haggadah, but says nevertheless, it is a mitzvah min hamuvchar. It's a beautiful drink to drink the 5th cup. Why am I telling you about this late on a Saturday night? Because listen to what the Gra says. The Gra says, we have a debate. We're living with doubt. And we don't know what to do. We have a tradition that says 4. We have a tradition that says 5. We're living in a state of doubt. We don't know what to do.
Our confidence has been shaken to its core. What should we do? You know who gives us answers when we have doubt? Do you know who has the solution when we are unsure? Eliyahu HaNavi. When the Gemara asks a question and doesn't have an answer and ends with the word, it says, Teku, Tishbi, Yitaretz, Kushas, Va'abayos, Eliyahu HaTishbi. Eliyahu will come and resolve our doubt. Eliyahu will come and restore our confidence, says the Gra. This fifth cup, the cup of Eliyahu, because we don't know, four or five, we come up with a compromise. We'll put a cup on the table and we won't drink it, and we'll fulfill both opinions. Why? Because Eliyahu is the one we rely on to help us resolve our doubt. My friends, we've come to the first message, the first symbol, the first lesson to draw from the cup of Eliyahu. The grief that we feel, the pain that is so acute, is the notion of doubt. In my life, I don't remember a period of such uncertainty. From whom will we get the next phone call with bad news? What will be the next data point? What will be the next recommendation? What will be the next executive order? What will be with the economy and the stock market? What will be in the world? I don't remember living through such a time of such doubt, of such uncertainty. And it humbles us, and it breaks our ego, and it worries us, and it shakes us. The doubt of not knowing, of not knowing. But my friends, that's where the cup of Eliyahu. At the end of your Seder Wednesday night, you're going to get up and you're going to go and you're going to open that door, and you're going to welcome Eliyahu, because as a Torah-believing Jew, we know that we are not subjects of randomness or chance, that nothing happens by accident. Everything is for a reason and by design. It's all the hand of God that has ushered our history until now, and that will direct and choreograph our destiny from now. And when we open that door, when we welcome Eliyahu, we are welcoming the Eliyahu inside us. That faith, that hope, that optimism, that confidence, the knowledge that we don't have to have doubt. There are so many things we don't know. But you know what helps us feel better even about all that we don't know? Is the one thing we know for sure. That there's an Eibishter, a Ribono Shalom, there's an Almighty. He runs this world. He is in charge. He presents a problem. He is the solution. And therefore, while we take every precaution, while we take every initiative, while we do everything we have to do and more, we're never crippled. We never fall apart by doubt because of the one certainty. In a world of so many variables, there is one absolute, the Ribono Shel Olam. He showed it in Mitzrayim when he redeemed us, and he'll show us today. Rav Volbe writes, the reason the Gemara makes a promise, if you're somech geula l'tfila, if you say the words Gal Yisrael right before you say your Shmona Esra Yamida, you promised the world to come. You promised such wonderful reward. What's the big deal? You read the Siddur in order? You said Gal Yisrael and then the Amida? Somech geula, big deal. You followed the words of the Siddur. What's the big deal? Says Rav Volbe. You know what Gal Yisrael means? It means I have an eye to my past. I'm not only living in the here and now present, I remember and I live, and it's my story that the Jewish people were in Egypt and God took us out. We had trials and tribulations in the desert and God rescued us. We've been through wars and persecution and oppression. We've survived plagues and extermination attempts. Gal Yisrael, He redeemed me in the past. Now I'm ready to say Me'amida for the present. He took me out. He transformed my reality. He redeemed me in the past, and that gives me the confidence, the knowledge, to take three steps forward and say, Hashem sefasai tiftach. A person with doubt can't daven. A person with certainty can lean on Hashem. When we say, Gal Yisrael, I was there, I remember. Every year I relive that experience when I thought hope was lost, and you came to rescue us, and you will again. And therefore, I don't have to be crippled. I don't have to fall apart by doubt. I can recover my certainty. You know, there's a phrase, many mistakenly think it's a chazal, it's not. Ein simcha ke'ataras ha-safik. There is no joy like resolving doubt. The Rama uses this expression in his Torah Sa'ula, Mitzudas David and Mishlei, doesn't appear anywhere in Chazal. But there is no happiness or joy. When you live with doubt and uncertainty, it's painful. It paralyzes you, it debilitates you. And when you resolve that doubt, you can feel simcha. Have your doubt resolved tonight. No, we will open that door and welcome Eliyahu Hanavi. He is a harbinger of certainty, of confidence, of absolute knowledge. That we will get back clarity. That we will recover. That we will yet earn an income and get a job. That our lives will return. We will yet celebrate simchas. And we will yet properly mourn and grieve losses. This pandemic and this horrific hatred and the challenges life throws at us. We will move on. It's what we've always done and it's what we will do now. Don't be crippled by doubt. Grab onto Eliyahu Hanavi with both hands. Tishpi Yitaritz Kushas Vabayos. We have so many questions. Why are so many suffering? Don't become crippled by the questions. Grab on to Eliyahu Hanavi and grab on to his confidence, his message of hope, his message of certainty, his message of faith, his message of optimism that not only will we survive and endure, but we will thrive, we will learn, we will grow, that we will look back and talk about how this caused us to become better people, how we were able to discover parts of ourselves we never knew, that we will look back, as difficult as it is, and even those going through the horrific losses we're going through, that somehow, at some point, if not in this world, in the next, it's all part of the Almighty's master plan. But the problem with the Vilna Gaon's explanation is that in some ways it doesn't make sense. What do you mean the cup of Eliyahu helps us? I don't know if it should be 4. I don't know if it should be 5. Oh, who resolves doubt? We'll put a cup in the middle of the table. We'll call a cup of Eliyahu, and that way we're hedging. We have a 5th cup, but we won't drink it. The problem is, why did that just develop among Ashkenazim, not Sfaradim at first? Number 2, why did it wait until the 16th century, the 15th century to develop? The debate between the Gaonim was several centuries earlier. And how does it even resolve the dilemma? You're not drinking the cup. If you have to drink it, you didn't drink it. If you're not supposed to drink it, how did it help to have it on the table? What does it even do? And the truth is, according to others, this cup is not poured as the 5th cup at the end of the Seder. You pour it all the way back at the beginning. Shulchan Aruch Harav, source 26, the Alter Rebbe writes, Noagim bevendina seilu limzo kosachad yoser me'am esubin v'koronos ha'koshel Eliyahu Hanavi. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch writes the same thing at the beginning of the Seder. You pour the cup at the beginning of the Seder and it sits there the entire time. So we're back to the drawing board. We saw the question, maybe it's kospogum. Maybe it comes from the idea that you can't re-drink the wine that you already made a bracha on. We had a dumping bucket in the middle of the table. We don't like that answer. The Vilna Gaon's amazing answer. Eliyahu resolves doubt. We ask questions on that. So I want to share a third and final answer and get into our message of optimism and hope tonight. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nieh Bidvaro. Rapidly, this custom that perhaps originally developed for a halachic idea of kospogum, according to the Gra, the questionable 5th cup, but became associated with Eliyahu Hanavi, and we pointed out in the 16th century, 17th centuries, began to proliferate. It spread almost universally. So much so that today, until we began, it's likely you didn't even know that the cup of Eliyahu is not found in the Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, Gemara, or Mishnah. What happened then? What does the cup of Eliyahu represent that in that period and at that time, Jews were so desperate for that message? Professor Yehuda Rosenthal suggests that it's not a coincidence we see the spread of the cup of Eliyahu right around the time of Gzeiras Tach V'Tat, the Khmelnytsky uprising. Khmelnytsky had recruited the Cossacks to rebel against the Commonwealth forces. He was successfully gained momentum. And in his uprising against the Polish forces, over 1 million of the Commonwealth were killed, and the Jewish people suffered horrific, horrific losses. A third of the Jewish people were wiped out. Jewish people were set back. Here, every time they made progress, they thought they lived with prosperity. Every time there was some calm and peace, And here they're set back yet again by something that doesn't even have to do with them. But with every uprising in Europe, the Jews became a scapegoat and they suffered tragically, suffered terribly. The Jewish Ukrainian communities from 1648 to 1658 were devastated by Gzeres Tach V'Tat, by the Khmelnytsky uprising. In fact, it's in that background, it's against that backdrop, because the people were so desperate for a message of hope and optimism. They were so beaten down and devastated. Who rises up in that time? A false messiah, whose name is Shabtai Tzvi. Born 1626, he dies 1676, and it's against that backdrop, on a battered people, who are so devastated and broken and eager to grasp any message of hope, that Shabtai Tzvi emerges. We know his story, and we know that ultimately 1666, he casts off his Jewish garb, and in front of the Turkish Sultan, he converts to Islam, he gives up his Judaism, devastating to his followers. It had a big impact for generations to come. The Emden Eibschitz controversy, and the Baal Shem Tov himself was involved in countless others. And so says Professor Rosenthal, you know when the Cup of Eliyahu became particularly relevant? When the Jewish people are beaten down, when we're broken, when we're worried, when we're afraid, that's when we began to put that cup in the middle of our table. It's when we began to get up and go open that door and to say, no matter what we're going through, no matter what we are enduring, we continue to embrace and draw a message of hope. We are a people of faith. We're not a people of the here and now. We bridge the past, the present, and the future simultaneously. And therefore, we open that door and we remember. We affirm our faith that we know it will yet be okay. How long? We don't know. The Black Plague, it took 7 years to come back. And the flu epidemic in the early 20th century lasted a year. How long will this continue to batter us? We don't know. But one thing we do know, we will come back. We will bounce back. Not just the American people and the economy and the world. We, the Jewish people, will fill the walls, the halls of our shuls and batei medrash. Will fill the sounds of simchas and bar mitzvahs and brisim and weddings. That we, the Jewish people, will come back. We open that door and we invoke the image and the message of Eliyahu HaNavi. And we know that one day we will return. Maybe it won't be the exact same again, but we will return to that life that we knew. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Livracha, source 29, writes, you know why Eliyahu HaNavi begins to make an appearance in this time? Because we're getting closer to the Geula. He writes, specifically in these later generations, when the time for the final redemption draws closer and the passionate longing for its coming grows stronger, that's when the custom of pouring a kos of Eliyahu has become widespread. We're feeling, we're tasting the Geula. We're almost there in the context of all of history and what we have endured and survived. And therefore, we're desperate. We're welcoming Eliyahu to come announce he has arrived. Mashiach is here. It's time. And in this period of the end of the Geula, when we feel it most, that's when this custom has begun. The truth is, my friends, the second half of the Seder is all about not just the past redemption. That's the first half of the Seder. The prolonged Magid section is all about recounting, retelling, reliving the story. But the second half, when we come back from the meal, is not about the redemption of the past. Pesach is an exercise in faith, in hope. It's all about our longing and anticipating the redemption that is yet to come. We just said it this morning in the Haftorah that we each read privately. Eliyahu brings the message of Mashiach. Eliyahu comes and says, lift your chin, put a smile on your face, open your eyes. Ivdu as Hashem b'simcha, be happy, because Mashiach is almost here. No matter what one is going through, when we do it with faith, when we do it with confidence that it's not random, when we do it with a countdown towards the final redemption, we find the capacity to do it with joy. The Aruch HaShulchan writes, "Bizchus emuna zu yavo Mashiach, v'yishpo chamasol abavliim shechor v'beis hamikdash, It's at this point of the Seder every year, not just a coronavirus year, not just a pandemic year. Every year at this point in the Seder, we get up and open that door and we look and we welcome and we long to welcome and invite Mashiach and his one who will announce his arrival, Eliyahu HaNavi. When we open that door, we do so with certainty, we do so with confidence, we do so with the belief and knowledge that he is going to come. But there's another message of Eliyahu I want to share with you. Because in the story of Eliyahu and Malachim, we all know, Yom Kippur ends with the declaration, Hashem Hu Elokim. Eliyahu HaNavi said it when he destroyed Nevi'ei Baal, when he eliminated the idolaters, and he declared for the world to heed that they're here, that there is one God. But then, that story continues with Eliyahu's faith in the Jewish people being broken, being shattered. And Hashem says to Eliyahu, you know, you doubt the Jewish resiliency? You doubt their capacity for faith in hard times? You doubt their staying power? Eliyahu HaNavi, you will never die. You're coming back to every bris, and you're going to visit every home on Pesach. And the Jewish people will open that door, and the Jewish people will welcome your arrival, and the Jewish people will show you, they will exhibit to you, they will prove to you that they are sticking with the plan, that they are with it. When we open that door this Wednesday night, don't just imagine Eliyahu HaNavi, turn to him and say, Eliyahu, look at our family. And if you're having a Seder alone, you could say it loudest, and you can say it most authentically. Eliyahu, never doubt the Jewish people. No matter what is happening, no matter what's going on around us, no matter how much fear and doubt, we are sitting like royalty, majesty, sitting at our Seder table at the night of faith, declaring our confidence in Hashem, living with a faith in His dominion and providence over us. Hashem is always in our lives, Eliyahu. I want you to come and see. Give a kick, take a look. Here we are. With what everything going on around us, we haven't hesitated, we haven't paused. We still clean for Pesach, and we're still making a Seder. And we're still declaring not only our freedom, but that Hashem is the one who brought it, our faith in Him. Eliyahu, never doubt the Jewish people. That is your mission, that is our charge this year, to open that door and exhibit and show Eliyahu HaNavi that we're still with the plan, that here we are, nothing has changed, that we look forward not only to His arrival, but we look forward to His announcing the arrival of the Melech HaMashiach to bring a redemption that is filled with healing and health, of safety and security, of prosperity and of simcha. And that's why we open that door. The Haggadah Shleimer of Kasha says we open the door to make sure, before we declare Shvuch HaMascha LaGoyim, you want to make sure there are no goyim in the bushes. You want to make sure there's no non-Jew right outside your home. He says it's a practical thing we open the door. But according to this explanation, no, we open that door not because Eliyahu can't come through the chimney. We open the door because we're waiting for His message. We open the door because we want Him to see. Look what's going on behind me. Look how with it we still are. Look how much we believe. Look how our faith can never be rocked or shaken. Here we are. And here we will be. Knowing the sun will rise and a better day will come. And everything is orchestrated from above with complete and absolute faith in Hashem. In a world filled with doubt, we have the ultimate certainty that resolves all doubt. Now, while it's become the universal custom to welcome Eliyahu, for intellectual honesty, I'll point out there are those who are opposed. There are those who are opposed on halachic grounds. The Gemara Erevin says the laws of Tchumen apply. There are those who are opposed on hashkafic grounds, who say there's a problem of Darchei Amori. It's a form of an idolatry or superstition to think Eliyahu HaNavi comes to our homes. The Alshech, the Shemi Shimon, based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin. But despite those voices of opposition, the universal custom has spread. And we observe it so beautifully. We affirm our faith. We welcome His message. We tap into His hope. The Chassam Sofer used to make the cup of Eliyahu the tallest on his table and the most glorious. The Notabi Yehuda, Rabbi Chezkel Landau, used to escort Elio down the steps after the Seder, and the custom among Belzer Hasidim was to walk Elio Anavi from your house to the shul. Don't try it this year, we're socially distancing. The Belzer Rebbe had a special chair for Elio Anavi, just like at a bris, we have the Kisei of Elio. Belzer Rebbe had his Seder the whole night. Elio doesn't just pop in, he is there. His message of redemption, hope, optimism, faith. We are proving ourselves to him the whole night. What do you do with the wine at the end? Some say pour it back in the bottle. It's not pogum. No one made a bracha. According to the Pesach Me'uvin, you drink it during the meal. We don't follow that opinion. Chassam Sofer would leave the cup overnight, and he would make kiddush the next day. Lunch, he'd make kiddush on the cup of Elio from the night before. And so what we've seen until now, a custom we take for granted, that we imagine has existed forever, is in fact relatively recent. What is it about? Perhaps it helps us resolve a halachic dilemma. What to do about kos pogum? Maybe for igra, it helps us resolve what to do with the fifth cup. But for all of us, it helps us rediscover that knowledge, that belief, that this world is not a fluke, it's not random, that we've come through worse, and times will yet again be better. Where is this Eliyahu Anavi? How is he able to be in all of our homes simultaneously? Are we really supposed to teach our children feel for ourselves he's there? Do you give him a shalom aleichem? Are you allowed to hug him? Did he wash his hands? Is he wearing gloves? Does he come with a mask? Does he have to distance himself from us? Where and who is this Elio Anavi? And I want to suggest to you tonight that when you open that door and you're looking for Elio Anavi, he's not on the other side of it, but rather, perhaps the Elio Anavi is each and every one of us. A chassid once went to the Baal Shem Tov in Meshbitz, and he said, Rebbe, I want to see Elio Anavi. Every year I pour his cup at the Seder, and every year I sing his song, and every year I wait, and I'm disappointed. I'm desperate to meet him. I'm desperate to welcome him. I want to see him already. So the Baal Shem Tov said, it's very simple. I'll tell you what to do. Get two boxes. One filled with food and the other filled with children's clothing. And before Pesach, I want you to go to Minsk. And on the outskirts of the town, right before the forest begins, there's a dilapidated house. Find that house and knock on the door immediately. Stand there and listen. And shortly before candlelighting at sunset, knock on the door and ask for hospitality. The chassid was so desperate for Elio Anavi, so he agreed. He filled the box with food and the other box with clothing, and he made his way to Minsk, and he found a dilapidated home on the outskirts of the forest, and he waited and he listened, and at the right moment, he knocked on the door. But beforehand, he heard the children saying, Mommy, we're hungry. It's Yontif. We have no clothing to wear. We have nothing to eat. What's going to be? And he heard the mother say, Children, I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know where it's going to come from. But we have to trust in Hashem. It's going to be okay. And the chassid knew at that moment, that was the time to knock on the door. When the woman opened it, he said, I'm looking for hospitality. It's almost Yontif. I need somewhere to stay. And she said, I'm so sorry, my holy brother. I'd love to welcome you. We don't even have food for ourselves. My children don't even have clothing. Chassid said, food and clothing? No problem. I happen to have with me a box of food and a box of clothing. And the woman said, please, you're welcome to join us. And she came in. So he went back. He spent Yontif. He waited there 2 days. He made it through 2 starim. He waited to find Elio Anavi, like the Baal Shem Tov had promised him. But the 2 days ended. There was no Elio Anavi. He made his way back to Meshbitz and he said to his Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, he said, Master, I waited. I did what you said. I packed the boxes. I listened. I knocked on the door. I waited. And I didn't meet the Elio Anavi. So the Baal Shem Tov says, are you sure you didn't see him? He said, no, Rebbe, I didn't see him. Are you sure? Yeah, I was there. 2 days of Yontif. Then you need to go back for the 2 days. Go back with a box packed with food, same house. And again, I want you to arrive right before sunset. And don't knock immediately, just listen. And when the time is right, knock right before Yontif. He was disappointed. He hadn't seen Elio, and he thought it was a fool's errand. But the Baal Shem Tov tells you something, you listen. So he made his way back to Minsk, the dilapidated house on the outskirts of the town. And before he knocked on the door, he gave a listen. And he heard the children say, "Mommy, we're hungry. We haven't eaten the whole day." "Children," said the mother, "do you remember when you were crying before the Seder? And you said you were hungry, there was nothing to eat, no food, no clothing, and I told you, just trust in Hashem." And lo and behold, there was a knock on the door. And out of nowhere, a man brought us food and he brought us clothing. He came with everything we needed. "My children, Kinderlach, I want you to know I think that man must have been Eliyahu HaNavi. And now you're crying again because you're so hungry. I promise you, Eliyahu HaNavi will come again." And at that moment, the chassid understood what his master, the Baal Shem Tov, had said. And he knocked on the door. My friends, this Pesach, don't look for Eliyahu HaNavi to come from the outside. Be that Eliyahu HaNavi. Knock on other people's doors. Make sure that people who can't afford matzah or wine or meat, take care of them if you have a few extra dollars. People who are alone or shut in, who feel isolated and abandoned, call them. Send them flowers, a card, FaceTime, connect with them. We have a responsibility not to sit back and wait for Eliyahu HaNavi to redeem us. Get up and go and be someone else's Eliyahu HaNavi. Knock on their door. Be their redemption. Levi Yitzchak of Berditch of the Kedushas Levi explains that it's Eliyahu who remains a Jewish hero. Moshe died, he went to the next world, and we haven't heard from him since. We learn his Torah every day, but he passed on from this world. Eliyahu, the Navi tells us, ascended to the heaven in a whirlwind. Eliyahu HaNavi never died. He remains in touch with us to today. He goes to every bris, and we give him a special chair. He attends every Havdalah, and we sing Eliyahu HaNavi. He comes to every Seder. He answers our questions. When we doubt, he reminds us to have confidence. When he doubts, we prove to him we've stuck with the program and have faith. We show him we are his mirror. We don't just wait for his redemption, but we get up and we are willing to be the Eliyahu HaNavi for others. Many of us are predisposed towards a sense of pessimism. We try to convince ourselves it's realism. We say, "Rabbi, nice talk. We should be more optimistic and hopeful. We should believe. But have you seen the numbers? Have you heard the news? Do you know the reality?" We think that things will only get worse. They'll never work out. What will be? That is not a Jewish voice. That is not a Torah message. That is not the best of who we are. Rabbi Wein writes in his commentary on the Haggadah, source 41, there are six songs at the end of the Haggadah that we don't know their authorship. Six poems. Why these and not others? He says, you know, they have mazel. You know why they were included? The Seder should be concluded, he writes, on a joyous note with a feeling of triumph and satisfaction. These poems assure us that eventually right will prevail. There'll be better times for Israel and all of humankind. The message of serene confidence and unmitigated hope that dominates these poetic words gain them permanent entrance in the immortal Pesach Haggadah. Six poems, we don't really understand, we don't even know who wrote them. You know why they're there, says Rabbi Wein? Because a Jew ends the Seder night, not negative or pessimistic, not realistic. A Jew ends the Seder night optimistic, hopeful, joyous, confident about the future. Pesach, he writes, embodies optimism. It teaches us that even the most vile circumstances, slavery and immorality, paganism, all can be overcome by human faith and effort and with the help of Hashem. And that is really the theme of Adir Hu and every other poem. And my friends, science has only now caught up to what the Jewish people always knew. I want to end by giving you practical advice. This is the point I usually get the email later that says, "Rabbi, why didn't you just cut right to the last few minutes? What was the whole beginning?" So we're at that point for those following at home. Save yourselves the emails. I want to give practical tips and advice for all of us, myself, my family, you and your family, how we can be more optimistic and how we can embrace the message and image of Eliyahu HaNavi, and how we can get up and open that door and see before our very eyes a promise of a brighter future that will put a smile on our face. Suggestion number one is Emunah. The first strategy and the ultimate message that Eliyahu leaves us with is Emunah Pshuta, the simplicity that God is always by our side. When we're struggling, He struggles with us. When we suffer, He suffers for us. That we are never alone. Even those who in this unusual year are forced to have the Pesach Seder unimaginably alone, you're never alone. Several years ago, I was at a bris. You know what a bris? You sit at a table and at first you can't even get a seat. And then incrementally, everyone has to go to work or drive carpool or has somewhere to go. And one by one, they get up from the table. So I was at a table at a bris, and it was me and one other person, Rabbi Finman. And I had to go to work. I had to go. But I felt very bad. So I turned to him and I said, Rabbi Finman, I feel terrible. But I have a meeting. I got to go. I'm so sorry to leave you alone. I feel terrible. Please forgive me. And he looked at me with a smile. And as sincerely and genuinely as anyone has ever said anything to me, he looked at me and he said, Holy Rabbi, I'm never alone. Don't feel bad. I'm always with Hashem. And he meant it. Sitting at a table alone by himself, if Hashem is in your life, you're never alone. You're singing the Haggadah for Him. You're asking the Manashtana to Him. You're saying a Dvar Torah and you're giving Him the greatest Nachas Ruach. He is in the room. He's present. He's there. Whether you're alone, or whether you're more alone than you usually are, or whether you just feel alone during this difficult time, Hashem is with us. And here's the amazing thing. Like Eliyahu HaNavi declared, Hashem Huah Elokim. I don't care what the Corona dashboard tells me. I don't care what the experts tell me. I don't care what threatens me. I'll take my precautions. I'll show them, live responsibly, carefully. And then I put my trust, Hashem Hu Elokim. It's all up to Him. And not only does that help you religiously, and not only does that help you in your righteousness, did you know that will actually help you with your health? There's a book I love, I've quoted it before, several years old. It's called The Survivor's Club by Ben Sherwood. And the book goes through and researches science, psychology, to understand why are some predisposed to survive more than others? Why is it? Some survive the plane crash. Some survive cancer. Some survive the attack. Some survive the Holocaust. He has a chapter on each one of these things. Why do some survive and others not? And there's no perfect answer, but what does science and what does research tell us? He's a Jewish guy, Ben Sherwood, and he writes at the beginning of the book that he does not believe in God. He's an agnostic at best. He's not sure. But he admits later in the book, and look at page 20, source 42. He says, when I started writing this book, I was somewhat skeptical about the role of faith in survival. As I admitted, I've always offered a few prayers during an airplane's takeoff and landing, but I was doubtful of their impact. But as I began to interview survivors around the world, I noticed a remarkable pattern. Overwhelmingly, they shared a belief that God and faith had sustained them through their trials. As many as 75 or 80% cited a higher power as an important reason for their survival. 75 to 80% of people said, it was my faith, it was my hope, it was my knowledge, it was my submission to God that enabled me and empowered me, that energized me and strengthened me to get through. So that's anecdotal. Nice. That's rabbinic. Anecdotal. Homiletical. Listen to what he writes in the next page. Page 21. Dr. Harold Koenig of Duke University Medical Center. Duke University, it's a real place. One of the pioneers in the field of faith and health. Founder and director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Health. He's written more than 35 books and 300 articles on how people's religious beliefs influence their mental and physical well-being. The fancy name for the field, this struck me when I saw it this week. The fancy name for this field, get ready, is psychoneuroimmunology. PNI, psychoneuroimmunology. It's the science of how your mind influences your health and how social and psychological factors like religion affect your immune and nervous system. This disease, coronavirus, Who are the people most vulnerable? Who are we most worried about? People who are immunosuppressed. People with a low immune system. Do you know what raises your immune system? Belief and faith in God. Turning to Him. Talking to Him. Confiding in Him. Protesting and objecting to Him. Thanking Him. Inviting Him to be part of your daily life. Faith builds your immune system. Not only does turning to Emunah during these difficult times give you the strength to get through them, it helps you physically, it helps you medically, it helps you scientifically. Psychoneuroimmunology, faith in God bolsters the immune system. Take the vitamin C and wash your hands and quarantine and wear a mask and say Tehillim and Daven. And most importantly, talk to Him from your heart, in between the words of the Siddur, the most authentic type of davening there is. Tell Him what's going on in your life, what you're scared about, what you're worried about, what you need His help for, what you disagree with Him and you protest that He's doing. Thank Him for the incredible gifts that you have. Number two is a sense of context. A sense of context of what we're going through. If you've lost a loved one, I have nothing to say other than you're in our hearts and our tefillos, and we love you. But if you haven't lost a loved one, if you have someone who's dangerously ill, deathly ill, we're davening from the bottom of our hearts. Our words of Torah tonight and always should be in their great tzchus, and we should celebrate their full recovery. But listen and listen carefully. If you are not challenged, your health or anyone around you, if you and your family are healthy, whatever problem you're going through right now is a first world problem. Rabbi, my oven's not self-clean. I had to scrub it. I can't believe it. Woe is me. What will be my first Pesach ever? I'm home. Can you believe it? What a tragedy. My friends, that's not a tragedy. Thinking like that is a tragedy. If your biggest problem is making Pesach, you are the most blessed person on the planet. And don't forget it for a moment. We have to have a sense of context to what we're going through. A sense of appreciation for the blessings that continue to surround us. If we're healthy and financially have a roof over our head and food on our table, even if perhaps we've taken a dip and understandably we're worried about what will come next, but don't neglect being thankful for what you have by focusing too much on what you're worried you'll be missing. Context. The Black Plague lasted 70 years. It wiped out millions of people. That's not to suggest this is nothing, not to minimize its impact. It's to give a sense of context. And I want to show that to you inside for a moment. This absolutely startled me. Rav Menachem Kasher was a great Rav, lived 1895 to 1983. He's the author of the monumental work Torah Shlema on Chumash. And in the introduction to his Sefer Shmos, it's source 43, page 22, he writes, he published his Sefer Shmos, his commentary, right after the Holocaust, after the war. And he writes that nothing they went through in this book, in the book of Shmos, the suffering in Egypt, pales in comparison to what we've just endured, to what we've just experienced, to the blood that was just spilled. And he says, woe unto us, shebederech nes nitzavnu mimabul adamim ha'iropi shenishpach al ha'olam kulo v'al ameinu shivim v'shiva. He says, woe unto us, what we've lost, almost destroyed utterly. What we've endured is the same, maybe worse, than what's in Sefer Shmos. The reality he describes in the zoomed in lens on that moment is so horrific. Fast forward just a couple years later. In his Haggadah Shlema, he writes, source 44, he writes, in his essay on the fifth cup, he says, you know the fifth language? The Hevesi. Listen to what he writes. Now in our time, when we've been privileged to behold the mercies of the Holy Name, His salvation, the establishment of the State of Israel, the beginning of the redemption and salvation from the exile of Edom, it is fitting and proper we observe the pious act, the drinking of the fifth cup as a form of thanksgiving. He went to the chief rabbinate of Israel, he went to the Gedolei Yisrael, his contemporaries and peers, and he said, we who have survived and who've merited to live with the founding of the State of Israel, it's time to drink the fifth cup. It's time to drink the cup of the Hevesi. We have arrived. He's brought us in. It is the beginning of the redemption. Now, of course, it wasn't accepted, and none of us do it. It didn't take root. But I share that contrast to give you context. In one moment, all hope seemed lost. And the next he writes, we're living in the era of redemption. We have to have a sense of context to the time in which we're living. You know, there was a simcha this week and I got an email from our members who had a grandson. And listen to the email they wrote. With their permission, it's shared in Source 45. Dear Rabbi Goldberg, good news is something we can all use. Wonderful news about a new grandson. Baby and mother are doing well, Baruch Hashem, good and healthy. Grace and I will not be there for the bris. In fact, I believe only Dani, Chani, and the Moel. I do not think our elder son Mark or our son-in-law Yaron, any of their sons, will be there. We will join via Zoom. Times are indeed very different, he writes. But at the same time, just this morning, Grace and I were imagining what it was like for her parents in March 1944, hiding in the abandoned warehouse in northern Italy's mountains where she was born. No heat, no food, hiding from the Nazis, delivered by her grandmother, Rav Shmuel Halevi Vosner's mother, and a very happy a girl and not a boy. I too have been eternally happy. Yup, things are different, but much worse back then. The sun rose this morning. The sun will rise tomorrow. The sun will rise forever. The world is not ending, and this too shall pass. I got the email, and I began to cry, and I wrote him, can I quote this email? Listen to what he writes back. Sure, we should all know. This is nothing as we sit in our air-conditioned houses with plenty of food, internet, and iPhones. 75 years ago, we had nothing except bitachon and faith. Of course, he's not talking about somebody in the hospital or davening for a loved one who's ill. But for the rest of us, this is, relatively speaking, compared to what our people have endured, we are blessed and we can't lose that context when we have a sense of hope and a sense of optimism. We are that Eliyahu HaNavi to help others. I was moved by the story on page 24, how those who've recovered a new Rochelle are not hiding under their bed. They're not saying, woe is me. They're donating their plasma to help the next person who's diagnosed with the virus. That's how we respond. Not by turning inward, but out. By being the Eliyahu HaNavi to others. By getting up and creating redemption. Why do we have to open the door at all? Can Eliyahu HaNavi come down the chimney, walk through the wall, come in the window? The answer is, if you want redemption, get up off the couch and make your way to the door and let the redemption in. We are the Eliyahu HaNavi. We are making that difference. Whether the person who anonymously sent $10,000 and said, help families who need, or I came and found in my mailbox $500 worth of supermarket gift cards and I looked for the note so I could say thank you, dropped off anonymously. These are Eliyahu HaNavis trying to make other people's lives better. Not looking inward, waiting for Eliyahu HaNavi to knock on our door, but knocking figuratively on other people's doors to make a difference in their life. Two more things. The language we use. The language we use is so important. If we want to be optimistic, if we want to be resilient, if we want to come through this with a smile and a joy and not having lost our health just from worry, we need to be more judicious and careful, more vigilant with the words and the language that we're using. There's an article on Source 47 that talks about a positive tone and optimistic language, real language, but especially when our children are around, not scaring them, understanding the threat and danger, laying out what we need to do, but using a positive, upbeat, optimistic language to point out not only the crisis, but within this crisis to also point out the opportunity that we're living through. There's a great cartoon on the bottom of page 26 for the camera. Ooh. This cartoon, two people are sitting side by side. They're looking out the same window. One sees only the bars. The other sees the magnificent scenery behind it. Which one are you? Looking out at this world, what do you see? Are you seeing the bars that are imprisoning us in our homes? Or do you see the scenery that has been created as a result? I saw this great meme. Also part of our vocabulary we didn't have till recently. Which one will your child be in 75 years from now? Oh, I remember the coronavirus outbreak in 2020. It was horrible. We were stuck in our homes forever. We couldn't go anywhere or go do anything. We were climbing the walls. Or will they say, oh, I remember coronavirus 2020. We had so much fun staying home from school for a month. We played Monopoly for hours on end. Will they say, it was a nightmare. My mother was terrified. We were washing our hands every 30 seconds. My father was screaming. Or will they say, there was no school for a whole month. We got to stay home. We made a 1,000-piece puzzle together. We are hanging, had it hanging on our room for years after. What will the message, what is the energy in our homes? We own that energy. We are the ones who are putting it out. What is the language we use? What is the atmosphere we are creating? The one who was an expert on this and he taught the Jewish world was the Rebbe Zatzal. The Rebbe had a positivity bias. The Rebbe believed, he invoked the research of neuroscientists Andrew Newberg and Professor Mark Robert Waldman, that words change our brain. In their book, Words Can Change Your Brain, they write, a single word has the power to influence the expression of genes that regulate physical and emotional stress. MRI scans demonstrate a single negative word can increase the activity and in the amygdala, the fear center of the brain. If we use negative and scary words, the fear parts of the brain light up. They compromise our immune and our health. They compromise our well-being. Positivity bias. Positivity language. Research shows the longer you concentrate on positive words, they literally shape and mold, they affect the brain. The Rebbe was incredibly careful about this. In fact, the Rebbe refused to use the word deadline. Why? It connotes death. Instead, he called it not a deadline, a due date, because it has a connotation of birth, a due date. The Rebbe wouldn't call a spiritual getaway a retreat. Retreat connotes regression and surrender. And the Rebbe said only onward and upward. The Rebbe was asked to endorse a hospital in Israel. He said, on one condition, if it's called a Beit Cholim, a house for sick people, I won't endorse it. Because if you're in there, and you're in the house for sick people, you're going to feel sick. So instead, the Rebbe insisted it be called Beit Rifuah, a house for healing. So the people there will know that they're coming to heal. The Rebbe didn't call it outreach, as if Kiruv, you're far away and I'm bringing you close to me. The Rebbe had incredible attention to the detail of how we use language. You know, he said, there's a vort, the same word, it's not coincidental. In Hebrew, the same word, davar, means word, and it also means to speak or speech. It also means thing. Why? Because the relationship between words and things is very close. Words manifest real things. Davar, daber. We create reality by the words that we use. Be vigilant, be careful. Be mindful, be intentional with the words, with the energy, with the attitude, with the atmosphere. It'll help and preserve our well-being and it will impact the people around us. And lastly, learned optimism. The ability that we can learn to be optimistic. We don't have to be fatalistic. Don't be sitting and waiting for the other shoe to drop. Don't assume it's going to strike your home. Don't think the worst is going to happen. That's not who we are. That's not what we believe. It's not how we live our lives. We shape our reality, not with a negativity bias or filter, but rather with a positivity bias, with a learned sense of optimism. Martin Seligman wrote a book, Learned Optimism. He said, optimists don't avoid life storms, but they weather them better and emerge from them better off. And he suggests, commit to optimism every day. We do it. We daven. And it's filled with optimism. It's an invitation to be optimistic. Every morning, before you even get out of bed, he writes, be optimistic. We do. We say, Moda'ani. Double down on gratitude. Seek out the good always. Look for that which to be grateful for. And trust in your capacity for life. So my friends, thank you for joining me tonight. Thank you even more, those who did, for sticking with me. In summary, the Cup of Elio teaches us that we can attain freedom from our taskmasters. We don't have to be in shackles. We don't have to be imprisoned. Imprisoned by a virus that restricts us to our home. Imprisoned by a reality that makes us fear the worst. We can embrace the message of Eliyahu. Tishbi yitaretz kushuz va'abayos. That Eliyahu will come and give us back our confidence that the one answer to all doubt is the certainty that it's all from above. That faith builds resiliency. It raises our immune system. That the words we use create the reality around us. Think good and it will be good. Describe good. use good language, positive bias, positive language, and it will create a positive reality. And so I invite you to join me this Wednesday night when we all collectively, within our own homes, distanced from one another, will open our doors. Don't just open your door, open your heart. This year, open your door and don't wait to be rescued. Be the rescue. Be the Eliyahu who helps other people. Be the person of faith who relies and turns to Hashem. Be the person who knows that we will have a brighter future when we do it together. Yei Ratzon HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give a full refuah shleima to those who are ill. He should bring a redemption keref ayin. As quickly as our world has been turned upside down, may it be set right side up and we come together so that this room soon will be filled again with the sounds of brothers and sisters of holy Jews coming together to turn to our Father in heaven and to thank Him for all that He has done and will continue to do for us. Chag Kosher v'Sameach and a good Yontif, healthy, happy, and holy.